Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. We have a big show for today.
I'll be the judge of that.
I'm sure you will. We have a story from me about my magical watch. Anna takes us to the Grand House, and we hear a ghost story from Grenada.
Amazing!
But there's more. We continue with Anything You Can Do, and Tom finally tells us about his donkey.
Mission accomplished. Well done.
So, buckle up with this 5-Minute Mystery.
Another 5-Minute Mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by Hawks. No, not the type that played football this past Sunday and beat the Dallas Cowboys. No, I'm talking about the kind that nest on cliffs in April through June. Also, they are known to have feathers.
Well, Mrs. Holmes, how do you like it?
Oh, it's beautiful, Ken. Just think, we'll be spending the rest of the month of August up here.
I always said the Adirondacks is the finest country in the world for vacationing.
Well, it's been so long since we've had a real vacation, too. There was always some murder or robbery to interfere with our plans. You know, being married to a private detective certainly has its disadvantages.
But starting today until the end of August, it's all pleasure and no business, Beth.
Ken, watch out!
Say, what's the matter with you? Don't you know any better than to run in front of a car like that?
I'm awfully sorry, but I was in a hurry to get some help. A man's been killed.
There he is, at the bottom of the cliff.
What is it, King?
Stay back, Beth. I wouldn't look over the edge if I were you. It's not a very pretty sight. I'd say that was about a 300-foot drop. He didn't have a chance.
I told him not to do it. I told him not to.
You knew him, then?
Yes, he was a friend of mine, Gordon Gray.
Gordon Gray? Why, Ken, that couldn't be the Gordon Gray we met at the National Museum.
He was curator of birds there. Did you know him?
Only slightly. Had a few talks with him when my wife and I visit the museum. I'm an amateur at birds myself. Did you work with him?
No, my name is Wallace, Carl Wallace. I was merely a good friend to Mr. Gray.
Well, how did it happen, Wallace?
Well, you see, Gray and I were walking along the edge of the cliff here. He invited me out on a field trip with him. He was pointing out some birds to me when suddenly he spied a hawk's nest on a ledge a little ways down the cliff.
Where's the nest, Wallace?
I really don't know. His eyes were so much keener than mine, he could pick out things like that almost by intuition. Hawks build their nests along the sides of cliffs, you know.
Yes, he told me that once.
Well, he said he saw some eggs in the nest. He'd like to get them. He started to climb over the edge, and I begged him not to do it.
He fell?
Yes, he'd gotten about 10 feet down the cliff when suddenly he seemed to get dizzy. He put one hand to his head, he wavered a moment, and then he fell.
Oh, Ken. And he was such a nice old man, too.
Yes, it's a pity anyone would want to murder him.
Murder? Well, what's the matter with you? I just told...
Nothing's the matter with me, Wallace, but things will be pretty exciting for you when you come up on trial for the murder of Gordon Gray.
What clue tipped off Ken Holmes that Gordon Gray had not met with accidental death, but had been murdered? The answer in a few moments, but first...
Wow. How did he see through that? What was it in his testimony that tipped off our vacationing detective? I'm thinking it might be hawk-related, or why have them in the story? The pattern for these mysteries suggests that perhaps we were told something important without telling us why. Let's find out.
Now, back to our story.
You're crazy, Holmes. I told you exactly what happened, and that's the truth.
Not exactly the truth. You were running away from the scene of a crime when I almost ran you down with a car, a crime you'd committed. Gordon Gray didn't fall 300 feet to his death. You pushed him. Your on-the-spot alibi wasn't bad, except for one thing. A highly rated curator of birds at the National Museum wouldn't have said that he saw a hawk's nest with eggs in it on this mountainside. At least not in the month of August. The hawk's nesting period ended in June. Don't put words in a dead man's mouth, Wallace. They're dangerous.
Professor of ornithology would never climb out on a cliff looking for hawk eggs in August. It just isn't done. Now my question to you is, did you know that? I surely didn't. This 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by Hawks Everywhere. Go Team Go! I've had a couple emails this week asking about the blog site. What is it and why is it? Simply put, it is the second home to the show. I have found that while the main site does almost everything it needs to do, there are a few functions it lacks. For example, the story submission page is not possible on the main site, but works great on the blog. Also, special pages like the one I created for our current novel, Anything You Can Do, can't be done on the main site. I write a weekly blog along with the show. Now, of course, the main site can do this, but the WordPress site have better tools to make it more available to be followed and seen. A lot of the links that you press on ronsamazingstories.com take you to the blog. I'll bet you've been there and didn't even know it. I've also had people ask about how you can view the show art from the podcast. In fact, our very own Tom Williams asked me that very question this week. All of the show art is posted on the Facebook fan page in a photo album. Now, what I do to create the show art each week is to put together a wallpaper quality version of it. Then I break that down into the thumbnail and featured art you see travel with the podcast. To see the original full art, simply head to facebook.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. The photo album with the most pictures is called The Timeline. Thanks for all the great questions this week. I almost have enough stories for the month of Spooky 2018, but wanted to make one last push to get more. Do you have a scary story to share and maybe just don't want to write it? I can help with that. Come to the main website, click on the contact tab, and tell me about it. We can set up a phone call or just keep it in the emails. I want to be armed with the best stories I can get to make the month the spookiest available on the internet. Good goal, don't you think? And now, these are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
Today's first story comes from, well, me. I call it the Haunted Fitbit. In truth, it's not a Fitbit at all. It's a Samsung Gear Fit 2, not to be confused by a Gear Fit 2 Pro. More on that later. To start this story off, you have to go back to July of 2017. That's when I changed phone carriers. As part of that change, I got a brand spanking new phone, the Galaxy S8. I'm not going to tell you how old my last cell phone was because it's kind of embarrassing. I had the new phone for only a couple days when I discovered that it actually tracked my footsteps. How it did that was a bit of a mystery, but there it was. Little did I know then that feature would change my life. I was walking a lot more and enjoying the challenge of hitting my daily step goal. It was then I began one of the toughest times in my life, In October of 2017, I had a bout with sciatica that hit me so hard I would actually spend the next few months in a wheelchair. All my legs were strong, but I couldn't stand the pain that occurred when I stood up. I underwent medical help, and slowly I was able to walk with a cane and then back to normal. It was a rough road, and all through the winter, that darn phone encouraged me every day to get out there and walk. First 400 steps, then 600 steps out to get the mail, then 1,000, then 2,000. I remember the first time I hit 3,000, and my phone chimed in with a gold star for the day. I had finally hit my target goal on Tuesday, February 13th, 2018. Well, after that, things returned to normal, and today I'm mostly pain-free, but I do have some days with back pain. Nothing like the shooting pains of sciatica. Those who know that pain, I'm sure, can understand the difference. Now, why did I tell you that story? Well, it leads into the haunted Fitbit. Samsung Gear Fit 2 2016 edition. More on that later. So now I'm walking each day and tracking my steps, which is a great thing to do, by the way. Both my sisters had Fitbits to help them. My younger sister is a marathoner, so she needed one. And my older sister got one as a gift from her son that I believe got her out walking more. It's amazing how these tech toys do that. The only way to make the numbers go up is to get out there and do it. Seeing how well my sisters were doing, I decided I wanted an upgrade. Taking the phone with you everywhere you go just isn't the best. Now, I could go for this simple pedometer, but these watches are amazing. Not only do they track your steps, they monitor your heart rate and give you an idea of how many calories you burn. You can also monitor your sleep, get your phone/text, and even play your music. However, they do have one downfall, and that is the cost. I decided I wanted one that integrated with my Samsung phone and would allow me to use Samsung's proprietary software. Enter the Gear Fit 2. A brand new one costs over $200. Last year's model is about $159. A bit more than I was willing to spend. Enter eBay. I found the 2016 model selling for $74. The ad said, gently used and no case damage. I decided not to bid. I clicked on the Buy It Now button and it arrived within a few days. When it got here, it was completely dead. So I had to set it up on the charger, wait for it to complete that. Then, to be safe, I did a complete system restart, upgraded it to the latest firmware, and set it up. I had no trouble. It synced up with my phone perfectly, and I was ready to go. I was now tracking my body 24/7, except, of course, when I took it off to charge it. Things went great. It went with me everywhere, and I was surprised how many more steps per day I was actually achieving. I was also surprised by my sleep patterns, but that is for another story. I didn't get the manual with my purchase, so after a few days, I decided to read up on how to use its features. I was quick to learn that it had an app store and added a flashlight app, which actually paid off rather quickly. Then I read how to add my music to it. This would mean that I could leave the phone behind on my daily walks. As a test, I added the Best of Jeff Lynne and the Electric Light Orchestra. I took off out the door, and immediately my favorite tune, Mr. Blue Sky, began playing. Now, I wish I could play a little of that song in the background for story effect. But hey, copyright laws say I just can't do it. However, I was a happy camper. That's when the weirdness began. After Mr. Blue Sky completed, this very strange music began playing over my Bluetooth headset. It was so creepy. It sounded like something from that classic movie of the 50s, Forbidden Planet. But even creepier. You know, the soundtrack by Louie and B.B. Baron. It played for about a minute, and then Jeff Lynne was back. I continued on, and again the creepy stuff came back, this time accompanied by a strange feeling that I was being watched. I looked around, and I was alone. I stopped and looked at my watch. After some fiddling around, I found a way to list the tunes in my watch's memory. According to that list, only Jeff Lynne was there. I decided to finish my walk and investigate this later. I was thinking that Samsung had put some samples on, although I didn't understand their music, so for the rest of the walk, I was periodically interrupted with these odd songs. When I got home, I read everything I could on the subject. Nothing said anything about samples, let alone songs that don't appear on the playlist. For the next few days, this repeated, and I decided to go back to carrying my phone with me, playing my podcast and music from there. That's when things took a turn for the weirder. I was listening to a podcast, and it just stopped playing. I pulled out the phone and found that it was paused. Then, while I was standing there, the weird music started playing again. I have to say, in my mind, I saw a finger pointing at me, and I felt mocked. I don't know how else to describe how I felt. Also, every time I restarted the podcast, it would play about 2 minutes, and then stop, and then this odd music would begin again. Too strange. I posted on the forums, read Samsung topics, and nothing helped. I decided to leave the watch behind one day and just take the phone. I had no issues at all. Everything worked perfectly. Now, I was thinking this had to be a glitch, so I decided to write an email to the eBayer that I bought it from to find out if he had any trouble with it. The reply I got back was he never used it. He had bought the watch at an estate sale. After a few more emails, I put it all together. A guy by the name of Peter passed away from injuries he got out snowboarding. From what the eBayer knew, he was a sports junkie and a gadget guy. His wife took all his toys and had a local garage sale. The eBayer bought a bunch of the items at great prices and, from what I gather, made a mint. Now, before I started this podcast, this thought would have never occurred to me. But what if Peter had somehow attached himself to this watch? Overall, I could find nothing wrong with it and nothing that explained the symptoms. I decided to reset the watch to its factory settings, checked the music playlist, which, for the record, was blank, and then recreated the original test. Mr. Blue Sky began playing again, followed immediately by that strange music from Forbidden Planet. I let this continue for a while, and then I stopped dead in my tracks. I was feeling watched again, so this time I said out loud, "Peter, this is my watch now. I understand why you liked it, but please leave me alone." I swear, after about 20 seconds, the music stopped. I glanced down at the watch, and it was completely dead and would not turn back on. When I got home, I placed it on the charging cradle, and it sprang to life. I waited for it to fully charge and found that it had lost its mind. So, I reset, resynced, and restarted it. After that, I've never had any other issues. About 4 days now. Now, I know all of this can be explained. That reset fixed it and nothing more. But if that's the case, why didn't the other two resets solve the problem? Also, how in the heck did the watch pause my phone and take over the Bluetooth headphones? I don't have an answer for that one. I am calling this a head scratcher. However, back before I started the podcast, I would have called it a software glitch. What do you guys think? Ron from Vancouver, Washington. This next story comes from my hometown of Vancouver, Washington, but I didn't send it in. The teller of the tale wishes to keep her name out of the funny papers, as she said it, so we'll just call her Anna. Here is Anna's story. Hello, Ron. I love the podcast and we never miss it. Thank you for all that you do. Many years ago, I visited the Grant House with my mother. No one was there but a curator seated inside the front door. He said we could tour through the building on our own, so off we went looking at this famous Vancouver landmark. I'm going to stop there for just a minute and give you a bit of history on the Grant House. Officers Row was established in 1846. This area was set aside to house U.S. military officers stationed at the Vancouver Barracks on the banks of the Columbia River. Fort Vancouver was originally a fur trade depot owned by the Hudson's Bay Company. The U.S. Army arrived in 1849 and officers took up residences. The oldest of these homes was built by Major John Hathaway and his company of 76 soldiers. The Grant name, however, would be added much later. Ulysses S. Grant was posted at Fort Vancouver in 1852 with the 4th Infantry. This was actually before the home was even constructed. Grant never lived there, but he did visit it in 1879. Just in case you didn't know, Grant was a general during the Civil War and later President of the United States. The home was renamed in his honor because of his storied service. Now, let's get back to Anna's story. We walked around the first floor and everything was fine. The second floor, however, felt a little creepy. As we went up the narrow stairs to the top floor, we were both overcome with anxiety, as if we were expecting someone to pop out and say, "Boo!" We only stayed on that top floor for a few seconds before running back down the stairs, past the curator, and out to our car. We got into the car and relaxed a bit, but then looked up to see a man in the window of the top floor. Several years later, I heard that the house really is haunted, and it wasn't our imaginations playing tricks on us. The top floor is all boarded up these days. I wonder why. Anna, that's really not her name, from Vancouver, Washington. Wow, Anna, I had no idea about that house. Of course, growing up here in Vancouver, I know the place well. I've even had lunch there many years ago. It's now called Eatery at the Grant House. I did a bit more research and found that yours is not the only story about the place. In fact, a local historian and ghost hunter has been to the place looking for a certain ghost. I think I'm going to try to contact him and see if he has any stories to tell. To Anna, I say thank you for your story. Our last story for this time comes from Hunter1118. I don't know any more than that. Also, I'm pretty sure that English was not Hunter's first language. When I tried to contact him, I never received any response. On the submission page, I asked people for permission to use these stories for the podcast. Hunter gave his permission for both podcast and publication. So I edited this carefully and read it for you now. Ron, thank you for the podcast. It means a lot to me. I live in Grenada, and in 2015, I was living with my family. We decided to move to a new home. My father searched for a home for a long time, and he found one in a nearby neighborhood. We decided to move ASAP. We loaded all our stuff and shifted there. Right away, my mom started to feel the presence of a weird thing as soon as she entered the house. Even with that, we unpacked all our stuff and set to live there. It was midnight that first night, and we had had our dinner and were going to sleep. I decided to stay awake and watch TV. Just after 1 a.m., I felt something just hit me on the back of the head. Then, after a few minutes, my brother screamed from the washroom. He said he saw a girl behind him in the bathroom mirror. I rushed to check, but found nothing there. Then I began to continuously hear strange noises of a woman screaming from the TV lounge. When I got there, I heard a girl screaming from the washroom. I then rushed to my parents, and all of the family members were there and were able to hear all of the noise. Just after 14 hours, yes, just 14 hours, we shifted back to our old place. When me and my father went back to pick up our stuff, the neighbors told us that there was a family of a father, mother, and their daughter. It appears the father poisoned his daughter with washroom detergents and escaped. The mother committed suicide in the TV lounge because she was very desperate. We got back home and told the family this story. We believe that we were lucky that none of the spirits followed us back to our old place. Hunter, 1118, Grenada. Well, Hunter, thank you for your story. I hope my edits were okay. I tried to leave it as close to your email as possible. I did some research on Grenada, and it appears the native language there is English. A few of your words threw me off, and I had to interpret what I think you meant. Please contact me so that I can make it right if I made any mistakes. Well, that's all for this time. I remind you to send me your stories, and I'll do my best to read them here, or you're welcome to read them yourself. Just go to ronsamazingstories.com and click on the story submission banner or the link that is in the show notes.
Up next is Chapter 15 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. If you missed last week, Bart Stanton didn't know he had a twin brother until he saw Mart's picture in the newspaper and called Stanley Martin. Apparently, both had been treated at the Neurophysical Institute. Meanwhile, the Knipe continues work on its communications device, convinced that the people of Earth are not the real rulers. And now, Chapter 15 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
Puck, puck, ping. Puck, puck, ping. Puck, puck, ping. Puck, puck, ping. The action around the handball court was beautiful to watch. The robot mechanism behind Bart Stanton would fire out a ball at random intervals, ranging from a tenth to a quarter of a second, bouncing them off the wall in a random pattern. Stanton would retrieve the ball before it hit the ground and bounce it off the wall again to strike the target on the moving robot. Stanton had to work against a machine. No ordinary human being could have given him any competition. Puck, puck, ping. Puck, puck, ping. Puck, puck, plunk. One miss, Stanton said to himself, but he fielded the next one nicely and slammed it home. Puck, puck, ping. The physical therapist, who was standing to one side, well out of the way of those hard-slammed, fast-moving drives, glanced at his watch. It was almost time. Puck, puck, ping. The machine, having delivered its last ball, shut itself off with a smug click. Stanton turned away from the handball court and walked toward the physical therapist, who was holding out a robe for him. "That was good, Bart," he said. "Real good." "One miss," Stanton said as he shrugged into the robe. "Yeah, your timing was off a shade there, I guess. It's hard for me to tell till I look at the slow-motion photographs. Your arms and hands are just blurs to me when they're moving that fast. But you managed to chop another 10 seconds off your previous record anyway." Stanton looked at him. "You reset the timer again," he said accusingly. But there was a grin on his face. The PT man grinned back. "Yup,
Come on, step into the mummy case. He waved toward the narrow niche in the wall of the court, a niche just big enough to hold a standing man. Stanton stepped in, and various instrument pickups came out of the walls and touched him at various points on his body. Hidden machines recorded his heartbeat, his blood pressure, his brain activity, his muscular tension, his breathing, and several other factors. After a minute, the PT man said, "Okay, Bart, that's it. Let's hit the steam box." Stanton stepped out of the niche and accompanied the therapist to another room, where he took off the robe again and sat down on the small stool inside an ordinary steam box. The box closed, leaving his head free, and the box began to fill with steam. "Did I ever tell you just what it is that I don't like about that machine?" Stanton asked as the therapist draped a heavy towel around his head. "Nope, didn't know you had any gripe. What is it?" "You can't gloat after you beat it. You can't walk over and pat it on the shoulder and say, 'Well, better luck next time, old man.' It isn't a good loser, and it isn't a bad loser. The damn thing doesn't even know it lost, and even if it did, it wouldn't care." "Yeah, I see what you mean," said the PT man, chuckling. "You beat the pants off it, and what do you get? Nothing. Not even a case of the sulks out of it." "Exactly. And what's worse, I know perfectly good and well that it's only half trying. The stupid gadget could beat me easily if you just turned that knob over a little more." "Yeah, sure. But you're not competing against the machine anyway," the therapist said. "What you're doing, you're competing against yourself, trying to beat your own record." "I know. And what happens when I can't do that anymore either?" Stanton asked. "I can't just go on getting better and better forever. I've got limits, you know." "Sure," said the therapist easily. "So does anybody. So does a golf player, for instance. You take a golf player. He goes out and practices by himself to try to beat his own record." "Bunk! Hogwash! The real fun in any game is beating someone else. The big kick in golf is winning over the other guy in a twosome." "How about crossword puzzles or solitaire?" "When you solve a crossword puzzle, you've beaten the guy who made up the puzzle. When you play solitaire, you're playing against the laws of chance, and that can become pretty boring unless there's money on it. And in that case, you're actually trying to beat the guy who's betting against you. What I'd like to do is get out on the golf course with someone else and do my best and then lose, honestly." "With a handicap," the therapist began. Then he grinned weakly and stopped. On the golf course, Stanton was impossibly good. It had taken him a little while to get the knack of it, but as soon as he got control of his club and knew the reactions of the ball, his score started plummeting. Now it was so low as to be almost ridiculous. One long drive to the green and one putt to the cup. An easy 36 strokes for 18 holes. An occasional hole-in-one sometimes brought his score down below that. An occasional worm cast or stray wind sometimes brought it up. "Sure," said Stanton, "a handicap. What kind of a handicap do you want me to give you to induce you to make a $50 bet on a handball game with me?" The physical therapist could imagine himself trying to get under one of Stanton's lightning-like returns. The thought of what would happen to his hand if he were accidentally to catch one made him wince. "We wouldn't even be playing the same game," said Stanton. The therapist stepped back and looked at Stanton. "You know," he said puzzledly, "you sound bitter." "Sure I'm bitter," Stanton said. "All I ever get is just exercise. All the fun has gone out of it." He sighed and grinned. There was no point in upsetting the PT man. "I guess I'll just have to stick to cards and chess if I want competition. Speed and strength don't help anything if I'm holding two pair against three of a kind." Before the therapist could say anything, the door opened and a tall, lean man stepped into the foggy air of the room. "You are broiling a lobster?" he asked the PT man blandly. "Steaming a clam," the therapist corrected. "When he's done, I'll pound him to chowder." "Excellent. I came for a clam bake." "You're early then, George," Stanton said. He didn't feel much in the mood for lightness, and the appearance of Dr. Yoritomo did nothing to improve his humor. George Yoritomo beamed broadly, crinkling up his narrow, heavy-lidded eyes. "Ah, a talking clam. Excellent. How much longer does this fine specimen of clamhood have to cook?" he asked the PT man. "About 23 more minutes." "Excellent," said Dr. Yoritomo. "Would you be so good as to return at the end of that time?" The therapist opened his mouth, closed it, then opened it again and said, "Sure, Doc, I can get some other stuff done. I'll see you in 23 minutes. But don't let him out of there till I get back." He went out through the far door. After the door closed, Dr. Yoritomo pulled up a chair and sat down. "There have been new developments," he said, "as you may have surmised." The physical therapist, like many other of the personnel around the Institute, knew of Stanton's abilities, but he didn't know the purpose of the long series of operations that had made him what he was. Such persons knew about Stanton himself, but they knew nothing of any connection with the NIPE, although they might suspect. And all of them kept their knowledge and their suspicions to themselves. "I guessed," Stanton said. "What is it, George?" He flexed his muscles under the caress of the hot, moist currents in the box. He wondered why it was so important that the psychologist interrupt him while he was relaxing after strenuous exercise. Yoritomo looked excited in spite of his attempt to be calm. And yet Stanton knew that, whatever it wasn't anything tremendously urgent or Dr. Yoritomo would be acting a great deal differently. Yoritomo leaned forward in his chair, his thin lips in an excited smile, his black irised eyes sparkling. "I had to come tell you. The sheer utter beauty of it is too much to contain. 3 times in a row was almost absolute, Bart. The probability that our hypotheses were correct was computed as straight nines to 7 decimals. But now, the 4th time, straight nines to 12 decimals!" Stanton lifted an eyebrow. "Your Oriental calm is deserting you, George. I'm not reading you." Yoritomo's smile became broader. "Ah, sorry. I refer to the theory we have been discussing, about the peculiar mentality of our friend the NIPE. You remember?" Stanton remembered. After 6 years of watching the recorded actions of the NIPE, Dr. Yoritomo had evolved a theory about the kind of mentality that lay behind the 4 baleful violet eyes in that snouted alien head. In order that his theory be validated, it was necessary that the theory be able to predict, in broad terms, the future actions of the NIPE. Evidently, that proof had now come. The psychologist was smiling and rubbing his long, bony hands together. For Dr. George Yoritomo, that was almost the equivalent of hysterical excitement. "We have been able to predict the behavior of the NIPE," he said, "for the 4th time in succession." "Great," Stanton said. "Congratulations, George. But how does that fit in with the rule you once told me about? You know, the one about experimental animals?" "Ah, yes," Yoritomo said, nodding his head agreeably. "The Harvard Law of Animal Behavior. A genetically standardized strain, under precisely controlled laboratory conditions, when subjected to carefully calibrated stimuli, will behave as it damned well pleases. Yes, very true." He held up a cautionary finger. "But an animal could not do otherwise, could it? Only as it pleases. Could it do anything else? It could not please to behave as something it is not, could it?" "Draw me a picture," Stanton said. "What I mean," Yoritomo said, "is that any organism is limited in its choice of behavior. A hamster, for example, cannot choose to behave in the manner of a rhesus monkey. A dog cannot choose to react as a mouse would react. If I prick a white mouse with a needle, it may squeal or bite or jump, but it will not bark. Never. Nor will it, under any circumstances, leap to a trapeze, hang by its tail, and chatter curses at me. Never." Stanton chuckled, but he didn't comment. By observing an organism's reactions, the psychologist continued, one can begin to see a pattern. After long enough observation, the pattern almost approaches certainty. If, for instance, I tell you that I put an armful of hay into a certain animal's enclosure, and that the animal trotted over, ate the hay, and brayed, then you will be able to tell me with reasonable certainty whether or not the animal had long ears. Do you see? Sure, but you haven't been able to pinpoint the knife's activities that easily yet, have you? Stanton asked. Ah, no, said Yoritomo, not at all. That was merely an analogy, and we must not make the mistake of carrying an analogy too far. The more intelligent a creature is, the greater, in general, is its scope of action. The knife is far from being so simple as a monkey or a hamster. On the other hand, he smiled widely, showing bright white teeth, he is not so bright as a human being. What? Stanton looked at him skeptically. I wouldn't say he was exactly stupid, George. What about all those prize gadgets of his? He blinked. Wipe the sweat off my forehead, will you? It's running into my eyes. Dr. Yoritomo wiped with a towel as he continued. Ah, yes. He is quite capable in that respect, my friend. Quite capable. That is because of his great memory. At once his finest asset and his greatest curse. He draped the towel around Stanton's head again and stepped back, his face unsmiling. Imagine having a near-perfect memory, Bart. Stanton's jaw muscles tightened a little before he spoke. I think I'd like it, he said. Yoritomo shrugged slightly. Perhaps you would. But it would most certainly not be the asset you think. Look at it very soberly, my friend. The most difficult teaching job in the world is the attempt to teach an organism something that that organism already knows. True? Yes. If a man already knows the shape of the earth, it will do you no good to teach him. If he knows, for example, that the earth is flat, but round like a pancake, your contention that it is round like a ball will make no impression upon his mind whatever. He knows, you see. He knows. Now, imagine a race with a perfect memory, a memory that never fades, a memory in which each bit of data is as bright and as fresh as the moment it was imprinted, and as readily available as the data stored in a robot's mind. It is, in effect, a robotic memory. If you put false data into the memory banks of a mathematical computer, such as telling it that the square of 2 is 5, you cannot correct that error simply by telling it the true fact that the square of 2 is 4. No. First, you must remove the erroneous data. Not so? Agreed, Stanton said. Very good. Then let us look at the knipe race, wherever it was spawned in this universe. Let us look at the race a long time back, way back when they first became knipe sapiens. Back when they first developed a true language. Each little knipe child, as it is born or hatched or budded, whatever it is they do, is taught as rapidly as possible all the things it must know in order to survive. And once a little knipelet is taught a thing, it knows. That knowledge is there, it is permanent, and it can be brought instantly to the fore. And if it is taught a falsehood, then it cannot be taught the truth. You see? Stanton thought about it. Well, yes, but eventually there are going to be cases where reality doesn't jibe with what he's been taught, aren't there? And wouldn't cold reality force a change? Ah, in some cases, yes. In most, no, said Yoritomo. Look, suppose one of these primordial knipes runs across a tiger, or whatever large carnivore passes for a tiger on their home planet. This knipe, let us say, has never seen a tiger before, so he does not observe that this particular tiger is old, ill, and weak. It is, as a matter of fact, on its last legs. Our primordial knipe hits it on the head, and it drops dead. It drags the body home for the family to feed upon. How did you kill it, Papa? Why, it was the simplest thing in the world, my child. I walked up to it, bashed it firmly on the noggin, and it died. That is the way to kill tigers. Yoritomo smiled. It is also a good way to kill nipes, eh? He took the towel and wiped Stanton's brow again. The error, he continued, was made when Papa Nipe made the generalization from one tiger to all tigers. If tigers were rare, this erroneous bit of lore might be passed on for many generations unchecked and spread through the Nipe community as time passed. Those who did learn that most tigers are not conquered by walking up to them and hitting them on the noggin undoubtedly died before they could pass this new bit of information on. Then, perhaps, one day, a Nipe survived the ordeal. His mind now contained conflicting information which must be resolved. He knows that tigers are killed in this way. He also knows that this one was not so obliging as to die. What is wrong? Ha! He has the solution. Plainly, this particular beast was not a tiger.
How does he explain that to the others? Stanton asked.
What does he tell his children? Yoritomo asked rhetorically. Why, first he tells them how tigers are killed. You walk up to one and bash it on the head. And then he warns his little niplets that there is an animal around that looks just like a tiger, but it is not a tiger. One should not make the mistake of thinking it is a tiger, or one will get oneself badly hurt. Now, since the only way to tell the true tiger from the false is to give it a hit on the head, and since that test may prove rather injurious, if not absolutely fatal, to the Nipe who tries it, it follows that one is better off if one scrupulously avoids all animals that look like tigers. You see?
Yeah, said Stanton. Some snarks are boojums.
Exactly.
Thank you for that illusion, Yoritomo said with a smile. I must remember to use it in my report.
It seems to me to follow, Stanton said musingly, that there would inevitably be some things that they'd never learn the truth about, once they had gotten the wrong idea into their heads.
Ah, indeed, absolutely true. It is precisely that which led me to formulate my theory in the first place. How else are we to explain that the Nipe, for all his tremendous technical knowledge, is nonetheless a member of a society that is still in the ancient ritual taboo stage of development?
A savage?
Yoritomo laughed softly. As to his savagery, I think no one on Earth would disagree, but they are not the same thing. What I do mean is that the Nipe is undoubtedly the most superstitious and bigoted being on the face of this planet.
There was a knock on the door of the steam room.
Yes, said Dr. Yoritomo.
The physical therapist stuck his head in.
Sorry to interrupt, but the clam is done. I'll have to give him a rub down, Doc.
Perfectly all right, Yoritomo said. We had almost finished. Think over what I have said, eh, Bart?
Yeah, sure, George, Stanton said abstractedly.
Yoritomo left, and Stanton got up on the rub-down table and lay prone. The therapist, seeing that his patient was in no mood for conversation, proceeded with the massage in silence. Stanton lay on the table, his head pillowed in his arms, while the therapist rubbed and kneaded his muscles. The pleasant sensation formed a background for his thoughts. For the first time, Stanton was seeing the Nipe as an individual, as a person, as a thinking, feeling being.
We have a great deal in common, you and I, he thought, except that you're a lot worse off than I am.
I'm actually feeling sorry for the poor guy, Stanton thought, which, I suppose, is a hell of a lot better than feeling sorry for myself. The only real, basic difference between us freaks is that you're more of a freak than I am.
Molly O'Grady and the Colonel's lady are sisters under the skin.
Where'd that come from? Something I learned in school, no doubt, like the snarks and the boojums.
He would answer to high or to any loud cry, such as, "Fry me or fritter my wig."
Who is that? The snark? No. The snark had a flavor like that of Will-o'-the-Wisp. and I must remember to distinguish those that have feathers and bite from those that have whiskers and scratch. Damn this memory of mine! Or can I even call it mine when I can't even use it? For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. Another jack-in-the-box thought popping up from nowhere. The only way I'll ever get all of this stuff straightened out in my mind is to get more information, and it doesn't look as though anyone is going to give it to me on a platter either. The Institute men seem to be awfully chary about giving information away, even to me. George even had to chase away old Rub and Pound. That feels good. Before he could talk about the Knipe. Can't blame him for that, of course. There'd be hell to pay for everyone around if the general public ever found out that the Knipe has been kept as a pet for 6 years. How many people has he killed in that time? 20? 30? How much blood does Colonel Mannheim have on his hands? Though they know not why or for what they give, still the few must die that many may live. I wonder whether I read all that stuff complete or just browsed through a copy of Bartlett's quotations. Fragments. We've got to get organized around here, brother. Colonel Mannheim's puppet is going to have to cut his strings and do a Pinocchio. That's it for Chapter 15. Join us again next week for another installment of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. As promised this week, Tom tells us about his encounter with a donkey and a pair of red shorts in a tale he calls...
Growing up, red shorts and donkeys don't mix. I've mentioned that my uncle had two plow mules. Well, my dad decided to get himself an animal to plow a small garden for Mom, more or less to expand the one she already had. He heard that his neighbor, about a half mile down the road, just might have a donkey for sale or trade. Now, for those of you who don't know any better, and my father didn't either at the time, there are very distinguishable working traits between mules and donkeys. There's not much to know. A mule will pull a plow, definitely, and a donkey will stand there and watch the mule pull a plow, definitely. That's what he thinks his job is. He thinks it over, and by the time he makes up his mind, it's quitting time. Being that my dad didn't have extra cash to purchase the donkey, he took along a drill to trade for it. Dad, me, and Fred set out on foot, and with drill in hand to the farmer. There was some serious dealing that went on, but my dad won out in the end. We put the guide rope around the donkey's neck and made our way home. Finally, Fred looked up at Dad and said, "When you traded that drill for the donkey, you knew that that drill won't run." Dad shifted the short stub of a cigar to the other corner of his mouth and smiled and said, "You know, Fred, this donkey won't run either." That was his justification. Halfway home, the sand got awfully hot on my bare feet, so Dad decided to let me ride the rest of the way. I put my foot into his cupped hands for a lift up, but I did a slight jump as he lifted. I sailed over the animal's back, and Dad caught me just in time by the foot. There I was, hanging and looking at the underside of the donkey. Close call, but we had many as kids. Mom had already had a small garden patch, as I mentioned. We got the donkey home, fed and watered him for the night, and left him on a long lead rope to move about and graze, get used to the property. Too long, I'm afraid, the rope was. The rope and the donkey ended up in a good portion of Mon's garden patch. The next day, after exploring the damage, Dad moved the rope further away from Mom's little garden and went on to work. A few hours later, when the housework was done, Mom filled a bucket, I believe it was water or maybe oats, and then her red shorts went out to give it to the donkey. Since Mom approached the animal from the rear, he didn't see her until he was, or she was, a few feet away. He took a look at her, and then the red shorts. He was startled again and charged her, chasing Mom back to the house, scaring the wits out of her. All I know is that that donkey was never to be seen later on again. I don't know what Dad did with him. Besides, the plan wasn't thought of well enough anyways. You see, we didn't even have a plow. Here's to the best plans made of mice and men. Sincerely, Tom.
We've heard quite a few stories from Tom now, and I'm thinking I see a pattern, and it's not just from his stories. I spent a great deal of my time looking at audio from history, be it OTR, old time radio, or radio sound bites. Something is quite clear. Time moved much slower in those days. Today, everything is fast paced and must have now. Then, what can I do today to make it to tomorrow? I was left with this. I kind of wish today moved as slow as back then. Thank you, Tom. And I can't wait to hear more about growing up. Podcast over. I want to thank our contributors this week, Anna, Hunter1118, Mark Nelson, and Tom Williams. Thank you all. Next week, the month of Spooky 2018 begins. We will open with my favorite OTR story, The Forble Board. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com and you will find all of the links you need. Please leave reviews and feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.